Welcome to Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman on the White Network.
These people are British citizens living in London. Some were born here, but some are new arrivals. They came, of course, to earn their living, but they also meet our urgent needs in essential jobs. Today, the post-war wave of immigration is falling off. Last year, there were only 16,000 new arrivals in Britain, and 10,000 of those were wives and children. There's been surprisingly little friction between white and coloured. Even in Notting Hill, everything is quiet again, thanks to the good sense of the community and to the work of churches, welfare workers, local authorities. But last month, a very different sort of organization opened its headquarters in the district. Mr. Colin Jordan is the national organizer of the White Defense League. I found him with two of his colleagues and asked him about the League's membership.
The White Defense League was only founded last September. We do not make a practice of revealing details of members, their names or branches. We prefer to be judged by our results.
Would you tell me how large it is, even without revealing details? How many members?
Naturally, as it only started last September, it is still a small organization, but its rate of increase is highly satisfactory.
Now, what are the political objects of the White Defence League?
The objects of the White Defence League are to keep Britain the white man's country that it has always been, to preserve the white civilization, which is the product of our race, to preserve our Northern European blood, which in our opinion is our greatest national treasure.
Well, now, what does that mean in real terms? Do you want the Negroes to leave England?
It means that we believe in the bold, vital step of stopping all coloured immigration into Britain and repatriating, with every humane consideration, the coloured immigrants who are already here.
Well, now let's look at the question of repatriation. Many of these Negro families, for instance, have been settled in England for generations. What are you going to do with them?
Naturally, we shall try and smooth the repatriation with, as I say, every humane consideration. We appreciate, of course, that there are bound to be inconveniences and discomforts, but against that we have to set the ultimate future of our nation. And if mass coloured immigration continues as it is doing now, it will inevitably mean a coffee-coloured, half-breed Britain of the future, and we are going to fight to stop that.
But isn't every civilised nation in the world a half-breed nation of some kind or other?
Not half-breed in the sense of a mixture of European and non-European.
An organisation with the opposite purpose was set up at about the same time, the STARS campaign for interracial friendship. I took Jordan with me to listen to one of their meetings. Several famous stars were there, Lonnie Donegan, Cleo Lane. The chairman is Johnny Dankworth.
Well, the objectives of the campaign are largely to counteract any cranky organizations which try to preach the gospel of a master race anywhere. So such organizations as Mr. What's-her-name's seem laughable on the face of it, but they aren't really laughable because Adolf Hitler started a similar organization about 25 years ago, which caused the deaths of millions and millions of people and the sufferings of millions more.
Now, it was put to me earlier by the spokesman of the White Defense League that colored people ought to be repatriated from this country to their country of origin. Now, where were you born, for instance?
Southall, Middlesex, or Southall, Middlesex.
So you're in fact a Londoner, you're an Englishman.
Yes.
Where would you be if you had to be repatriated? Where would that be to?
Southall, Middlesex.
You know, in my little span of life, I've come across such a sea of bigotries and prejudices that, you know, I get so fed up with it now. I feel I have to do something about it.
Mr. Braithwaite, you're a visitor to this country, although you've been here for, I think, something like 15 years. Does it discourage you and upset you very much when you come across the kind of propaganda we've been hearing about today?
Not for a moment. You see, it indicates to me the strength of British democracy that Mr. Jordan or his associates can say this sort of thing, and they are free to say it. You see, it also indicates to me that democracy means something to the British people. They can contain this sort of thing, just as a healthy body can contain a boil or a pimple. If it becomes painful, then they'll take steps to deal with it.
there were a lot of angry people outside the registry office waiting for the wedding of British National Socialist leader Colin Jordan. He wants to convert us all to Hitlerism, presumably with himself in the role of the British Hitler. What a creed, in Coventry of all places. Here comes 40-year-old Jordan, probably relishing the trouble. His bride is Françoise Dior, a niece of the late King of Paris fashion. She is also very pro-Nazi, a marriage of true minds. Jordan signed the register and quietly prepared to face the crowd.
Aerial bombardment for the guests, not as bad as the Blitz, but enough to indicate the popularity of National Socialist leader Colin Jordan, British Nazi number one. His French bride, Françoise Dior, is reported to have said, "All I want is little Nazi children."
The Jordans left after a blood-mingling ceremony when each nicked a finger, pressed them together, and let a spot fall on Hitler's Mein Kampf. Police arrested some anti-Nazis, and it was all over.
Welcome to episode 7 of John Tyndall on Voice of Albion. First, you heard a segment from a panorama program from 1959 entitled White Defence League. Second, you heard a video called A National Socialist Wedding from 1963. National Action held a successful leafleting session in Birmingham last Saturday and are doing so in Essex this weekend. If you live in the UK and would like to get involved, visit their site at national-action.info. The National Front stood in a by-election in the northern town of Todmorden recently. The results: Lib Dems, 203 votes, Labour, 123, Independent, 71, National Front, 59, another independent, 53. That's 10.3% for the National Front candidate, Chris Jackson. Turnout was just 19%. And now, chapter 9 of John Tyndall's 11th Hour, Years of Political Apprenticeship. I've gone back to summarising this week. I think it's better for listening and is a better way of doing things. The only reason I might not summarise in the future is only if I haven't had any time to prepare, in which case I shall just have to read a chapter verbatim. But all being well, all possibilities, I shall summarise like I do today. Start. JT recalls in a previous chapter he described how he reached the decision to devote his life to political work. He states, by enlisting as a member of the League of Empire Loyalists, thus began a period of activity lasting about 10 years, during which many mistakes were made. Little had been achieved apart from a series of lessons of do's and don'ts in politics. As a result, JT had become a wiser person and therefore better able to put the future years to good effect. At the same time, he was able during this period to develop certain capabilities which were to stand him in good stead later. He mentions public speaking. There was also writing, which combined, as he went on, with the techniques of production of printed material. During this time, JT states, he founded his own small publishing concern and launched a journal, Spearhead, which possibly became the most successful patriotic periodical in post-war Britain. Practice at organising and personal management was also gained. JT remarks how these things were always on a shoestring budget, and contrary to the far left's belief that our side is heavily subsidised by big business, the reverse is actually true. That is to say, it's the far left who are funded by rich unions and the like. Among the many lessons learned in these years was the futility of splintering. One of the characteristics of those years was the bewildering succession of organisations that came and went, due to the tendency of their chief operatives to frequently fall out and then feel bound to formalise their quarrels by fragmenting their already tiny organisations into even tinier ones. All of this was the product of a certain immaturity of character, combined with an inability to see the greater picture and take what JT describes as the big view. JT freely acknowledges that he was not without guilt himself in this respect during those earlier years. He was young and headstrong and says, "I had an awful lot to learn." It was during those early years that he came to know something of the human resources available to the patriotic movement. JT talks of the egotism which drives many, and that a position in a political group, however tinpot it may be, was compensation, in many cases, for personal failure in the big wide world. Conversely, JT states, he met some very fine people whom he became proud to call his friends. Eventually, he became convinced that much of this warfare between people who are supposed to serve the same cause is generated by our opponents, who are not above placing their agents in our ranks specifically with the purpose of promoting quarrels and splits in pursuit of the strategy of divide and conquer. JT entered the political fray in the middle of the late 1950s, being confident that there would be a fully adequate supply of people of outstanding ability to the patriotic movement. It was not long before he realised that this expectation had been, to say the least, naive, and that the number of those of the calibre for this task was extremely small. It was not until this realisation dawned that he began to consider any role for himself in the movement beyond that of rank and file, disciple and follower. JT points out, "It is very rarely in this world that we encounter people of truly outstanding talent who are at the same time totally indifferent to questions of personal reward or the approval and applause of their contemporaries, and who are prepared to apply their great capabilities to working for aims that may take years to come to fruition, during which time they are likely to be condemned to a position on the outer fringes of society, prophets without honour, as it were, until some destined cataclysm, which they among very few have foreseen, arrives and justifies their warnings, at the same time turning upside down the criteria by which human worth is judged and therefore transforming them from pariahs into popular heroes." At any rate, JT continues, "It was on discovering how few were qualified for leadership of the movement I had joined that I first began to see my own political involvement as a true vocation. It was then that I thoroughly set about educating and training myself with a view to taking, in the years ahead, a major share of responsibility in this struggle." JT reiterates he joined the League of Empire Lawless with the idea that out of it something better might come. He was impatient and wanted the League to assume the role of a fully fledged political party. He saw no future in its function as a mere pressure group, because he felt it was quite clear that the opinion it sought to change, which was basically a conservative opinion, would not be changed. Although JT respected A.K. Chesterton as a writer and observer of national and international affairs, he did not see eye to eye with Chesterton on this matter and recalls a clash was inevitable. In the course of his activities in the League, JT met John Bean. Their talks established that they had much in common, particularly that a political party should be formed. JT, with John Bean and others, partook in the formation of the National Labour Party, with Bean as leader. The thinking behind this choice of name was mainly Bean's, but JT did not oppose it. They had despaired of trying to appeal to people of Tory bent, and there was a feeling that the message should now be pitched in another direction. Tory is another word for conservative in Britain. JT points out, "A vast number of people support Labour who are not leftists. Bean's reasoning was that they should break new ground in trying to reach these people with an image and a programme that was radical in scope, combining nationalism with a kind of popular socialism, shorn of left-wing ideology." The National Labour Party, beginning in 1958, had a career of 2 years, during which it recruited 500 to 600 members. At about the same time, another organisation had come into being. This was the White Defence League. The WDL was not a party but a pressure group, like the League of Empire Lawless, and had been formed solely for the purpose of opposing coloured immigration. But the late 1950s beginning to become a very real problem. The WDL was headed by Colin Jordan, It was smaller in size than the National Labour Party, but had the advantage over the latter of possessing a headquarters building, a shop premises in Princedale Road, London, W11. In 1960, the two organisations, recognising they were on parallel paths, began discussions towards a merger of forces, which took place during that year with the formation of the British National Party, under Jordan as leader and Bean as his deputy. The party had no connection to the one John Tyndall led at the time of writing the 11th hour. The identity of title is purely coincidental. JT gave his support to the new formation with the same reservations earlier with the NPL and became a fairly active member. During his time, JT continued to do quite a lot of public speaking, mainly outdoors and at impromptu meetings of the soapbox variety. One meeting became a fixture. It was a street adjoining London's Earl's Court Road, where they appeared every Wednesday evening for a time. JT reminisces, "As our political opponents got to know about our scheduled appearances, they regularly turned up to heckle and chant abuse. This all provided good training for the speakers, including myself, but sometimes the opposition went beyond the merely vocal, and there were scuffles. It was out of this that there began a series of encounters with the law that have punctuated my political life, and out of which my opponents have done their best to make capital. When our meetings were attacked, we defended them. That may seem highly peculiar, not to say provocative, reaction to people accustomed to the idea that the best response to the left wing of rowdyism is to run away from it. But defend our meetings we did." JT then talks of how a left-wing trouble causer swung a punch at him. JT hit back, was arrested by a policeman, and had a tough hand around his collar. Although not resisting arrest, he was struggling to breathe. When attempting to loosen the grip, he accidentally struck the officer without realising. He was charged not only with disorderly conduct, but assault on a police officer. The judge accepted JT's version of events, and he received a small fine. JT was unhappy to have a criminal record following the incident. He strongly states that political activists should not interfere with the police doing their job, and the conviction is something contrary to his old approach to politics. "As our small movement began to make a bit of an impact," JT goes on, "opposition to it built up and started to become more unpleasant. This opposition never came from the ordinary public," he points out. "They reacted to the meetings with much more sympathy, although with a great deal of apathy. Their opponents consisted of members of left-wing political groups and also organised Jewish bodies, such as Mosley had encountered earlier." A quick note about the Battle of Cable Street in 1936. It tallies up a lot with what John Tyndall is talking about here. There is plaques in London and other cities to the great, brave local people who fought against the fascists, Mosley's fascists, at Cable Street. However, if you look into it a bit more carefully, you will see that most of the local people did in fact support Mosley, not least going by his election results at that time, which was quite high in Shoreditch, and I think it was Bethnal Green. But most of the people who was against it actually were not even from London. Jewish organisations actually shipped people in from Manchester and Liverpool and other places, and it was some gangsters and Jews, non-Jews, who formed that barrier where now you've got Muriel's painting of, oh look, you know, the brave Londoners stopped the fascists. Well, that's all very untrue. The local people did not fight against Mosley. As I say, it was people from outside, and mostly not British people either. Continue. "Their opponents consisted of members of left-wing political groups and also organised Jewish bodies, such as Mosley had encountered earlier. In fact, they had said very little on the Jewish question at that time, but had concentrated mainly on opposing the new presence in Britain of West Indian and South Asian immigrants. What JT and his contemporaries learned from this was that, as soon as anyone takes a stand against the intrusion of these new arrivals, the Jewish community, or at least its most political active members, will tend to line up on the side of the latter. JT reiterates that many Jews take an ambiguous position on racism, condemning it in others but being only too willing to practice it themselves. Against this build-up of violent opposition, JT recalls, some of us began to feel that we would need to take firmer measures to ensure our own defence and safety. An idea began to form of a disciplined body of men who would undertake this task as a special function with the party. Upon the decision of Colin Jordan, this body was formed. JT was one of those who endorsed the decision and he indicated his willingness to take part in the project. The development of this self-defence force caused a great deal of dissension in the early BNP. Jordan was for it and he was leader. Bean was against it, and so was the party's president, Andrew Fontaine. JT states that a not inconsiderable body of members backed Bean and Fontaine on the matter. JT regrets that a sly little plot was hatched by means of which a meeting of the party's council was convened, with Jordan, its leader, not even being informed about it. At this meeting, a decision was made to expel Jordan, John Tyndall, and other prominent members associated with the defence group. The members' files were stolen and removed to a place outside Jordan's reach, and the party members were then circularised with a bulletin explaining what had happened, but without Jordan and his supporters being able to reach those members on their own behalf and give their version of events. Jordan and Tyndall and others were expelled from the party without even being given the chance to testify in their own defence. This was the spring of 1962. Quick note, John Bean is now with Andrew Bronze's new political party, the British Democratic Party. As pointed out by current National Front leader Kevin Bryan, John Bean has compromised on several key ideological issues in recent times. Continuing, JT adds, he relates this little episode not because it is itself of any great importance, but because it was indicative of a tendency that he described earlier in the chapter, and it is something which repeated itself in the coming years. JT then talks about Colin Jordan setting up a new party called National Socialist Movement. JT regretted joining Jordan in this endeavour, but stresses that no one forced him into it. He was 28 years old and admits he had a lot to learn. The National Socialist Movement enjoyed a career of about 2 years, during which it won national and world publicity out of all proportion to its size and importance. During this period, JT had two further brushes with the law. The first occurred as a result of a public meeting held in the NSM in Trafalgar Square in July 1962. One of the Jewish organisations referred to earlier set along a large mob whose intention was clearly to stop the meeting being held and, if possible, to administer some physical injury to the National Socialist Movement. JT states that this was one of his early lessons on the tendency of certain elements in the Jewish community to set themselves up as the arbiters of who may and may not hold a political meeting in Great Britain. When the mob made their attempt to smash it up, a large riot ensued. The police handled things with admirable efficiency and the peace was restored, allowing the meeting to proceed to its conclusion. Following the meeting, prosecutions were taken out under the Public Order Act. JT and Colin Jordan, not the instigators of the riot, were charged with using words in their speeches that were construed as provoking the disorder. They appeared in court and were given prison sentences, which in JT's case was reduced to a fine. This episode led JT to a serious study of the Public Order Act and to a realisation of what an infamous piece of legislation it is, both its original conception and its subsequent application. The Act was introduced in 1936 to deal with the disorder of the kind attending the meetings and demonstrations held by Sir Oswald Mosley's British Union. These disorders, JT points out, on the admission of the police involved at the time, caused without exception by Mosley's opponents. Part of the Act forbids the wearing of uniforms in public places by any political organisation, this arising out of the use of such uniforms by Mosley's defence squads for the simple purpose of telling colleagues from opponents. On the Public Order Act of 1936, JIT adds, this tendency is increased by another section of the Act, under which, in the event of an organisation planning to hold a march or public demonstration, and in the subsequent event of its opponents threatening an outbreak of disorder against it, that march or demonstration may be banned from taking place. Again, this legislation says to those who have no respect for the law, go ahead and threaten a riot against people you dislike, and the law will then oblige you by having their activity banned, even though it may be perfectly peaceful and lawful in intent. Naturally, JT adds, the mobsters of the far left have welcomed this anomaly of the law with open arms and have exploited it for all it's worth. JT concludes, the overwhelming impression that one gains of the Public Order Act is that it was introduced and has subsequently been implemented, essentially with a view to curbing the rights of patriotic organisations and not to the preserving of the public peace, something in which it has manifestly failed. Shortly after penalising the Nationalists in 1962, the powers that be struck again. This time they were prosecuted under the same Public Order Act for taking part in the special formation they had organised for their own self-defence. Colin Jordan and JT were charged, along with two others, Dennis Pyrie and Roland Kerr Ritchie. These four consisted half of the defence group. The trial took place at the Old Bailey and received big publicity. The jury threw out the first charge but found them guilty of the second, which was that their activities had been such as to cause reasonable apprehension, that they might have trained or equipped for the purpose of using physical force in the promotion of a political object. In other words, JT adds, we were convicted not on the basis of any proven facts, but purely on someone's supposition of what someone else might think. People who are familiar with the forces at work in Britain would not be surprised to hear that there was no prosecution of the leaders of the Jewish organisation, by this time known openly as the 62 Group, which had promoted the riot in Trafalgar Square a short time earlier. India has its sacred cows, on which no hand of harm must ever be laid. Britain is no different, JT adds. They went to jail, Colin Jordan as an arch-villain getting 9 months, John Tyndall as villain number two getting 6 months, and their two colleagues getting 3 months each. JT then remembers his experience in prison. In 1962, October, I found myself on the wrong side of the tall wall that surrounds Worth Mud Scrubs Prison in West London. Colin Jordan was with me for about a month, after which we were split up, my being sent to Stafford Prison in the West Midlands, and he to Spring Hill Open Prison in Buckinghamshire. My stay at Stafford was not a long one. Our case had received, as I have said, a lot of publicity, and of course there were people on the inside of prison who were only too eager to inflict harm on us. At Wormwood Scrubs, we had always walked the exercise yard together, and this safety in numbers, combined with the fact that neither of us was a 7-stone weakling, seemed sufficient to discourage trouble. At Stafford, I was on my own. Soon after I arrived, someone approached me from the rear on exercise and delivered me a blow to the head. It was not hard, and I suffered no injury, but I lost my bearings for just long enough for my assailant to disappear into the crowd before I could identify him. Within a day of this incident, I was lying on my bed in my cell with the door temporarily open due to it being slop-out time. I had completed my own operations in that regard and was waiting for the officer on duty to look me up. A black prisoner suddenly appeared and emptied a bucket of dirty water over me and was then gone in a flash. I was not hurt, although hardly pleased. I saw out the remainder of my sentence at Sudbury, an open prison in Derbyshire, with little trouble. In the long off-duty hours, I was able to retire to the library and listen to music and play chess. There was also a table tennis room I frequented quite often, and I finished runner-up in the prison knockout competition. There was plenty of books to read, and I was even able to write an article for the prison magazine, which caused quite a stir. Eventually, JT was released, and he resumed his activities. A short time later, Colin Jordan was released and things reverted to normal. The National Socialist Movement enterprise was not to last for more than a year. JFT recounts two further events from that time, both in 1963. The first occurred when three or four members of the National Socialist Movement were walking down Kensington High Street off duty from party activities one evening. By a strange stroke of misfortune, they must have been spotted shortly before by someone in contact with the Jewish 62 group to which I have referred. By whatever means, I do not know, but a number of members of this group were tipped off and sped quickly to the scene. A mob of about 20 of them set on our men out of the blue and completely without provocation. One of our people, a Newfoundlander named Charlie Thompson, was very badly beaten up and subsequently hospitalised for several weeks. After that, we never saw him again. Shortly after this incident, and with very fresh in our minds, the MSN held a general party conference at London's Claxton Hall. As an indication of how small the organisation was, there was no more than about 30 in attendance. The 62 group had got to hear about the conference through an informer they had placed in our ranks, and they set a mob along to attack it. Small though our numbers on the occasion were, our opponents had obviously expected them to be even smaller, for when the mob turned up, it was no more than about equal in number to our own members present. They came in shortly before the meeting was about to start. It is my usual preference, when troublemakers come along to disrupt meetings, to favour the minimum use of force to remove them. Quite apart from the ethics of the matter, this is political common sense, since, if more than the necessary force is employed, potential supporters might be alienated. On this occasion, however, as soon as we saw who the intruders were, the thought of our friend in hospital leapt immediately to our minds. It would be telling a lie if I said that in the ensuing fight, our adversaries were ejected in a spirit of gentlemanliness. I saw one thrown over the banister to the floor about 30 feet below. The mob were giving a pasting that I suspect none of them ever forgot, and it is more than probable that local hospital staff had to put in some overtime later that day. JT stresses that he is not glorifying violence by recalling these events. It is to give the reader some indication as of the circumstances in which the struggle has been carried on. JT states, "Our whole political climate in Britain today is one of paralysis on the part of law-abiding people in the face of mob terror. Liberalism has emasculated our people's instincts, our proper instincts, when it comes to dealing with those who use violence and intimidation to gain their ends, and we shirk the duty to respond to them in the only language they understand and the only language they will ever understand." Shortly afterwards, the splintering tendency of which JT has spoken revealed itself again, and in the spring of 1964, the National Socialist Movement fell apart. At this stage, JT considered going into the temporary retirement phase regarding political work in order to concentrate on his personal affairs, not least financial, which had suffered greatly. Events forced his hand, however. People from the NSM made it clear they was looking toward him for leadership. They wanted to continue in some kind of political activity. JT agreed to set up an alternative organisation. This in due course came to be the Greater Britain Movement. With the formation of the GBM, he found himself for the first time to be leader of a political group as opposed to someone's lieutenant. He had by this time developed considerable confidence in his own powers. He had, over the preceding years, worked with various others and found them lacking in the necessary qualities of mind and character for leadership, or, in cases where someone did have these qualities, he was set on a course with which JT could not agree. In the latter category, he placed A.K. Chesterton, Colin Jordan, and Sir Oswald Mosley, all gifted men, but men who, at the time, did not share his very firm ideas about the correct way forward. JT then talks about setting up his journal Spearhead and credits his wife, Valerie, for the final type and the laborious task of getting the work printed. He also expresses gratitude to those who donated towards the endeavour. In 1966, he looked for additional employment and found a company who employed him as a manufacturer's agent. For the next 11 years, he sold hundreds of the products of this company, with only a small number of hours each week allocated to the work in question. This helped JT clear his debts, to buy and run a decent car, and to finance the expansion of his publishing activities. From 1964, his dedication was increasingly directed to the achievement of unification among nationalist political groups. He kept the Greater Britain movement alive, only with a view to its making a contribution to unity as soon as that became possible. In 1966, JT began to enter into consultation with people belonging to other groups who shared his sentiments on the matter of unity, and after a while, a good friendly relationship was established. It was clear to JT from the start that he could campaign and negotiate for unity much more effectively if he did not attempt to make any terms concerning his own position in the scheme of things, but on the contrary, volunteered to take a background seat. There were five organisations of any note in the field of nationalist politics in Britain. Apart from the Greater Britain movement, there was the British National Party, under John Bean and Andrew Fontaine. There was the group headed by Colin Jordan, by that time had reformed under the name of British Movement. Finally, there was the Racial Preservation Society, a group similar to the one-time White Defence League, not a party but a pressure group, concentrating solely on the immigration issue. He could not see any prospect of British Movement agreeing to link up with or being accepted by the others, if they had to be left out of the reckoning for the time being. Between the other groups, what was obviously desirable was a straight amalgamation. He believed the best man to lead this combination was A.K. Chesterton, provided he could be persuaded to venture into the political party field. His first discussions were with the representatives of the British National Party. Out of these, he hoped to be able to progress towards agreement to a merger between the BNP and the Greater British Movement. Then, when this agreement had been reached, to present the plans to Chesterton and invite him to bring in the League of Empire Loyalists too, with him leader of the whole. The name JT favoured as the one to be adopted by the new amalgamated body was National Front. This idea, not his in the original, but had been taken from a small party led by Andrew Fontaine in the early 1950s, which enjoyed a small career. JT states that things would have progressed rapidly towards an achievement of this project, had it not been for the depressing small-mindedness and obstruction of certain people in the BNP. He had to sit back and wait patiently in 1966 and 67, while fellow negotiators contended with people in their own ranks. It was duly reported back to him that no progress had been made, and it seemed that negotiations towards unity had broken down. Disappointed, he directed his mind back to his own small field of activity, resigned to the likelihood that fragmentation would for the time being continue. A little while later, to his amazement, he heard that his unity formula had been adopted to the letter, with the one exception that his own group be excluded. Agreement had been reached for a merger between the British National Party, that's the original British National Party, and League of Empire Loyalists, with A.K. Chesterton as leader, and for the new organisation to be called the National Front. The Racial Preservation Society would remain in existence, but would narrow the range of its independent operations and devote the resources saved to helping the NF, exactly what he had advocated. JT let things rest for a while, the National Front in the meantime being founded. JT decided he would make a direct approach to A.K. Chesterton to disband the Greater Britain movement and place all its members and assets at his disposal unconditionally. JT met Chesterton sometime in the spring of 1967 and made the offer to him. Chesterton's first words were, "What is the quid pro quo?" JT replied that there was none. They shook hands and put past conflicts behind them. JT then describes his time in the National Front. "Of the period of what I have described as my political apprenticeship, that part spent in the National Front was undoubtedly the most important, in respect both of the useful activity engaged in and the lessons learned. My involvement in the National Front dominated the 12 years of my life between late 1967 and the end of 1979. That party represented the first really serious attempt to organise a patriotic movement in Britain in the post-war era, and at its peak in the middle to late 70s, it had grown to a strength which caused tremendous concern to its adversaries. A.K. Chesterton, whose influence on JT's own political development was the dominating personality in the front from its foundation in 1967 to his retirement at the end of 1970. JT was asked to take over the party leadership after a further bout of internal divisions in 1972. He accepted, though with strong reservations about the new party constitution, which gave him limited powers amongst the committee structure. From the time of his assumption as leader, the party embarked on a period of rapid growth, both in membership and popular support. By the general election of 1974, the NF had become strong enough to contest 54 seats and qualified for 5 minutes broadcasting time on TV and radio. I've tried to find the 1974 election address by the National Front, but unfortunately I cannot find it. The new Labour government's lack of a majority led to the Premier Harold Wilson calling for a further election in October 1974. In this contest, the NF fielded 90 candidates. As before, the votes were modest, but two more broadcasts brought in a flood of inquiries, which led to further growth in membership. At the time that all this was happening, however, a faction in the party was organised itself against John Tyndall. Busy with the elections and confident that his record as leader said all that was needed to be said on his behalf, he didn't take the threat too seriously. "That was a mistake," JT says, retrospectively. At a meeting of the directorate just after the October election, he was deposed as leader and his place was taken by a relative newcomer named John Kingsley Reid. Upon Reid's death in 1985, it was revealed in the far-left wing Jewish magazine Searchlight that he had, for some years, been one of its undercover agents. I'm going to play something now about undercover agents in the National Front.
There was a chick on Charlotte who didn't crack a smile.
Race, like CND, was an issue that galvanised thousands to march through Britain's streets. The difference was that, unlike CND, race provoked violence as the far right and far left clashed. The secret state decided that both sides had to be targeted. Special Branch recruited a spy to infiltrate the National Front.
I placed him within that organisation. He rose to a certain level within the organisation that I wanted him to rise to very quickly, so it was easy for him to access information.
You have the ability to merge so much into the background that socially people feel able to freely talk with you sitting there, because you're accepted like part of the furniture.
One of the key targets for the far right in the Midlands at the time was a leading light of the Labour Party, known for her plain speaking.
How was Claire Short regarded?
Loathed. What would be described on the extreme right as a race mixer. She was constantly attacking the role of the National Front. She advocated multiracialism constantly on TV. Generally a bad lot she'd have been regarded.
I get a lot of hate mail. I get racist letters from all around the country saying, oh, you're in favour of immigrants and we're the too many already. I think they've got to be challenged.
Some members of the National Front plan to rid their area of this turbulent socialist using methods more familiar in Northern Ireland.
Were there plans to get her?
There was talk about firebombing her home because she lived in the constituency. And there was also plans for her to speak at the Trades Council. And they were planning to plant an incendiary device under the stage where she was speaking from.
Were they planning to kill her?
I think that would have been an added bonus for them.
Steve heard they planned to start by torching the Communist Party bookshop in Birmingham.
It was decided to nip it in the bud as soon as possible. And they were in fact all arrested at the first event, which was the attempted incineration of the Communist Party bookshop.
Where were they arrested?
Behind the premises, with the materials, yeah. They were tried and convicted and sent to prison.
How did they come to be caught? How did the police know?
Well, that's fairly obvious, isn't it? Because they had the information provided to them by me.
Steve then felt the fear that grips all spies at such moments. Would the finger of suspicion point at him?
When things go wrong, they all start thinking of the main players, don't they? Well, who was there? And the more forceful you were in the conversation at that time, the more likely you are to be remembered. And, you know, many's the time people used to say, well, obviously you're not under, because you weren't there, were you? When in fact I was.
How would you describe him as an agent?
In right-wing circles, the best agent I've ever dealt with.
So, there you go. I don't know if the person referred to as Steve in that recording was actually John Kingsley Reid, but you get the idea. Continue. Following the Reid takeover, the NF was rent by further internal divisions, which lasted 15 months, until JT was restored as leader. Then there followed another spectacular period of growth, during which the National Front became a household name in Britain and much spoken of in the world beyond. A series of demonstration marches, attended by very large numbers, met with an ever more hysterical reaction from the party's left-wing opponents. This resulted in a number of clashes of the violent kind which made media headlines, the biggest being at Lewisham in South London in 1977. It was noticeable that in the news media reporting of these clashes, there was very seldom any honesty employed in directing the blame. The violence was wholly due to unlawful attempts by the left-wing rowdies to stop perfectly lawful public demonstrations, but from the media's treatment of the issue, the public might have received the impression that the NF was at least half responsible, if not more so. Between general elections, the NF regularly fought by-elections. A by-election is when a councillor or MP stands down, is sacked by their party or dies, and elections to local government. By-elections enabled the party to concentrate its campaigning resources rather than dispersing them. In West Bromwich in May 1973, the party obtained 16.2% of the vote. In local elections in London, Leicester and Lancashire, it made big gains on several occasions. In these areas, there was won 20% of the vote. JT then goes on to detail the 1979 general election and the media hostility aimed at the NF. This was covered in the last episode on Voice of Albion. JT continues, we would have liked to have done better, but our achievement in fighting over 300 candidate seats gave us a great deal of cause to be proud of, so far we'd come in just a few years. In the situation, JT faced some tough decisions concerning the future direction of the party. He had to reckon on the probability of a period ahead in which growth would be more difficult due to the honeymoon with Mrs. Thatcher, which had diverted the support of many naive right-wingers, in quotation marks, away from us. At the same time, he had to deal with internal instability due to factors listed. There was an additional factor, the discovery of a homosexual network in the party, the toleration of which would have been contrary to all its principles and all the public declarations it had made on the subject. Note, here John Tyndall must be speaking of the homosexual Martin Webster. Webster still speaks on the nationalist talking shop circuit, welcomed by Troy Southgate to speak at New Right events. The old faggot Webster is actually speaking at the London Forum this weekend. Continue. At the first meeting of the NF Directorate in 1980, JT put his cards on the table. He told the assembled company that he was not prepared to continue leading the party and taking responsibility for its fortunes unless he was invested with proper leadership powers. He said that he required the calling of an extraordinary general meeting of party members at which he intended to present them a set of proposals for changes in the party constitution which would give him powers he needed. If the directorate declined to call such a meeting, it would have his resignation as party leader by the last day of the month. It did decline, and he did resign. By the beginning of 1982, JT's collaborators and he realised that the NF could not be saved, and they were determined to form a new party. This was formally at a meeting in London in 1982, formally announced and named the British National Party. JT was unanimously elected as leader and given the kind of executive powers he had sought, but being denied in the National Front. John Tyndall ends chapter 9 on a personal note. One very happy legacy remains from the National Front period, as far as I'm concerned. In 1975, I met, and 2 years later married, my wife, Valerie. Her father and mother, Charles and Violet Parker, had recently joined the party and had become very active on its behalf. Valerie followed them, or taken up membership a short time afterwards. We very quickly found we had a great deal in common, being about 99% in agreement in our views about politics and most other things, and this naturally helped bind us together. My life is a kind which it would perhaps be asking too much for any conventional woman to share. We were wed in November 1977, and I have never regretted the step. A year and a half later, Valerie presented me with a beautiful daughter. I will not name her, as she is now grown up and has her own life to lead. As with my brother mentioned earlier, I don't want to create problems for her in that life. I will only say that the love of these two dear ones has been a constant refuge and comfort to me in the often stormy times of my political struggle. Something for us all to think about, perhaps. That ends chapter 9 of John Tyndall's 11th Hour. Next Sunday, we'll go through chapter 10, entitled Roots of the British Sickness, The Political System. Now I'll play out with a recent set of speeches from Yorkshire. First is the nationalist activist Darren Law, who I know and count as a friend. And secondly will be the National Front chairman, Kevin Bryan. Thanks for listening. See you next week. 14 words.
When you live in a predominantly white area, like I do, the locals think that all this third world Islamic immigration only affects other areas, and not their own. But all this third world Islamic immigration will enter their predominantly white areas because of the loony left-wing Labour Party MPs and the loony left-wing Labour Party councillors. They don't want a predominantly white area. So what they do is they introduce this third world Islamic immigration via newly furnished immigration centres like the one we've been to today on Angel Lodge, Grand Wakefield Prison. You see, immigration in this country, especially this third world immigration, is like Japanese knotweed. I'll put it in that context. Japanese knotweed. Because when it's taken root, when Japanese knotweed takes root, it's damn hard to get rid of. And it's the same with this immigration. When these immigrants come to your area, they receive free housing, free healthcare, and their children bypass the school process, and their children go to schools before our children, which I don't think is fair. They do not assimilate, and they do not integrate into our way of living, our society. Your area will never ever be the same again. They'll change your culture, they'll change your history, and they'll change your heritage. What will become of our children's and our grandchildren's future? What will become of them? Think, people, we are being systematically replaced by a genocidal establishment, and they want to rid our country of the indigenous people. The white race is under intensive attack, not just from coloured skin invaders, but from our own treacherous kind in the form of the Liberal government, hiding behind the guise of democracy, which is nothing but a sham of the word. If democracy means that 30% of white British people vote, which in case 10% of them are non-Indigenous and the foreign, that is for them to rule over us, stealing from us, brainwashing us, and beating us into submission, along with making laws that strive our own right of freedom of speech, our own right of freedom of movement, and their own right of freedom association. And also the right to peaceful protest against the same non-indigenous and the replacement of our people with third world species that aren't in the same race as us. We are being replaced while our people sit down watching television that is subliminally pumping positive images of their own world, contradicting the stark truth that is on the streets. This is our country, and unless we make a stand, it will be well and truly taken away from us by a collection of greedy foreigners seeking a money for nothing lifestyle at our expense. And greedy money grabbing bankers, or should I say banksters, and their puppet politicians whose sole purpose in life is to line their own pockets with the money and wealth that belongs to the white indigenous British people. Yeah. And now I'm going to introduce you to the party's brand new chairman, recently elected, Mr. Kev Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, fellow nationalists, fellow whites. As Daz and Kev has said, I'd like to thank everybody for coming here to Wakefield today. It's a good turnout. Some people have travelled many miles to be here, but we've been out today in the centre of Wakefield. We've shown the white people of Wakefield that there are people out there who care, and we are prepared to get off the backsides, and we are prepared to stand against immigration, and like we have today, against the Angel Lodge Immigration Centre. So thanks everybody for coming today. Right, going back in history a little while, quite a long while, 1191, a place many, many miles away in the Middle East. The leader of the Muslim army, Saladin, had launched a number of harassing attacks on Richard, King Richard the Lionheart. But on this day, this very day today, the 7th of September in 1191, Saladin launched one further attack on Richard's forces. To start with, Richard the Lionheart was a little shaky, but the Crusaders, his mighty army, were rearing to go. They'd had enough of these harassing attacks of Saladin. Anyway, they got ready for the battle, and one regiment, the Hospitallers, had had enough, and they broke ranks. They charged at the Muslim army. Richard, being the leader that he was, seized the moment, and he let all of his cavalry go at the Muslim hordes. He committed every one of them to this mighty battle. And on that day, the Crusaders defeated Saladin. They sent him into the ground. Now, Richard the Lionheart is a king that led by example. And after that day, the coastal area of Palestine, southern Palestine, and the port of Jaffa were once again under Christian control. So we come forward 822 years. We come to the shores of our own nation. And the only resistance to the growing Islamic hordes of today are people like you in this room with us today. Because we look at our royal leaders of today, and there's no comparison to people like Richard the Lionheart. Instead, we have a queen sat there in her ivory towers, never uttering a damn word about the invasion, what's going on in her own country. And then we look at the clown of a son, Charles, who would sooner put a silly little piece of rag on his head, take his shoes off, and go kowtooing to the Muslims in the mosque, and standing there with the white British people saying, hang on a minute, we're very, very worried about what's happening to our country. We're going to make a stand. No, he'd sooner sit in a mosque with them with that silly little piece of rag on his head. What a disgrace! And this is the future king. Ladies and gentlemen, in every British town and city. These filthy animals are grooming and raping our young white girls. And when they're caught, they're given prison sentences. Pitiful prison sentences. They're put in jails together where they can practice the filthy religion, the vile religion, and the white people, the white loners in the prisons, are being forced to convert to their religion. What a disgrace. These pathetic excuses for human beings. They've committed the most vile, disgusting acts against our young white children, the young white girls, and now they're lording it up, paid for in jails. They're getting everything, the televisions, the prayer rooms where they're congregated. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the National Front will never be happy until every one of these people is swinging by the neck. Because for far too long, the local authorities, the do-gooders, the liberal bleeding hearts have ignored the cries of our young children. They've ignored it. Not only have they ignored it, they've sent police round to some of the girls' parents saying that their girls were prostitutes. And we know that because that's happened in our own area in the northwest. Well, last year, ladies and gentlemen, it was claimed that 5,000 young white girls have been systematically gang raped and groomed by these animals. And we know it's continuing to this very day. We certainly know it's happening in the northwest. It's happening in just about every part of the country. And you know, the other thing, we also know that in this country, our country, there are over 80 Sharia courts in operation up and down the country. 80 Sharia courts, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, at the moment, all they're doing is giving their own judgment with their own people on things like marriage and family disputes. But let's look at the bigger picture, ladies and gentlemen. We also are pretty sure that many of these honour killings, these bodies of the young Muslim girls that are being found, and these honour killings have been carried out on the order of the Sharia courts. To me, there's no doubt in that. The self-styled Sharia courts. And what is our government doing about it? Oh yes, they keep committing our troops to foreign wars. What are none of our business? They're trying to show that they're being tough with Muslims. But what about the Muslims? The Muslim armies on our own country, on our own land. What are they doing about that? Bugger all, apart from appeasing them, giving them houses, giving them money, everything they want. That's what they're doing about it, ladies and gentlemen. City after city are becoming majority non-white. Bradford, just down the road, already non-white. Leicester, in the East Midlands, already non-white. Our own capital city, London, is now a majority non-white. Our politicians have failed our people all the way down the line. The capital city of our country, what has been ours since time immemorial, has now fell to the non-white hordes. And you know our politicians, these people like Kev said, or Daz said, who believe in democracy, they've given it away. That's what democracy does for the indigenous people. The situation for whites in our country is nearly as bad, apart from the mass murder, as South Africa. And we can look at South Africa as an example of what we have got to come, ladies and gentlemen, in the next 20 years. Because let's make no mistake about it, we are heading to be a minority in our own land. And that is a fact. Our people in this country are being murdered, mugged and raped by foreigners who don't belong here, who have no right to be in our country. And we are told, the indigenous people of our country are told, that we have to welcome these people. We have to make them feel wanted. We're told that these people are our equals. Well, ladies and gentlemen, many of these people are not even equals. Many of these people are just savages coming from war-torn countries where it is commonplace to put a tie around somebody's neck and set fire to them. And yet we're told these people have to be welcomed here, and they change because we're a civilised nation. These people come here and they'll change and they'll become civilised people. Well, we all know, don't we, ladies and gentlemen, that is a damnable lie. We even saw on May the 22nd this year, young drummer Lee Ripley brutally murdered on the streets of our capital city. Now I'm telling you this, had that not been filmed by members of the public, we wouldn't have known what was going on. We'd been told it was just another murder in London.
Yeah.
But thankfully, thankfully, the public filmed it. And what did we see? We saw one of those savages stood there with blood dripping from his hands, the blood of drummer Lee Rigby. These two murderers are now kept in a British jail, paid for by the taxpayer. By the taxpayer. We are paying for it, and okay, one of them's had a bit of a beating. But ladies and gentlemen, these two savages should be dragged out and publicly executed by a firing squad. That Lee Rigby served with, they should be given the honour of dispatching these savages. That's what they should be given.
Yes.
And in the aftermath of Lee Rigby's murder, we, the National Front, were really the only political party to take to the streets. You never saw the BNP, they attempted it in London and they failed badly. But we took to the streets and the town and the towns of this country. And in many northern towns, we marched through one town to the next. And we had a fantastic reception from the public. They lined the streets and they applauded us. The public want us. And we're going to be there to let them know that we are the people who gives a damn. We'll hand our leaflets out. And I'm telling you now, the membership of the National Front, I intend, within the next 2 years, will swell well beyond 2,000. Well beyond it. And you know, the demos and the marches we hold over Lee Rigby gave us encouragement. It's given us a glimmer of hope that at long last the downtrodden white people of our land are beginning to get angry. They're beginning to wake up. The National Front is Britain's oldest white nationalist party. Our name, the National Front, from years ago, is deep in the conscious of every British man and woman. And it is our job, like we have done today, to get out there, to win over the hearts and the minds of the British public. We have to get out in our communities, and we have to stand there, march through our communities with our heads held high. Because this is our country, and our love for our race and nation is above all else. Let's make no mistake about it. Our numbers today have reached about 50. But one day, the British people, the people who came to us today, they will be marching with us, side by side, in mighty columns. Let's make no mistake about it. Because, ladies and gentlemen, our time will come. In our heart, we have the spirits of past generations, of our ancestors, our heroes who fought to secure this land, and we are not going to give it up because the politicians, the traitors in Westminster, tell us that we have to sit back and accept everything that's going on. We're not going to give it up. The spirits of our brave ancestors want repatriation. They're looking down at us saying, these people don't belong here, they have to go. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the National Front demands repatriation. Together, united, we will march. Together, united, we will crush our Marxist enemies. Together, united, we will secure our land. Together, white people, bonded by blood, we will win!
Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion on the White Network.